We are joined on the program now by local archaeologist John O'Rourke. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Right, I'll take the listeners back to 1811, because in December of that year, a Royal Navy frigate sank off the coast of County Donegal, and the mystery surrounding the final resting place of part of the wreck may now finally have been solved. Recent sand displacement caused by high winds at Ballymastocker Bay in Loch Swilly have revealed that some believe to be the remains of HMS Saldanha. Before I get your view on whether or not these are in fact the remains or the wreckage of this ship, talk to me about this Royal Naval frigate and how it may have come to perish off our coast.
So back then, Greg, the vessels that plied their trade around the coast, it was like, if you can imagine, the equivalent of articulated lorries today. There were lots of them. There were continuously small, locally owned and large ocean-going vessels in and around the coast of Inishowen. It's hard to appreciate now the level of traffic there actually was. Because of the wars that were going on in Europe at the time, the English stationed a small flotilla at Rathmullen. And they patrolled what was known to the English as the Northern Approaches. So anything really north of us on the approaches to the UK would have been interdicted by the ships based in Rathmullen. So a frigate, a large vessel, but not large on the scale of things. If you've seen the Victory, for instance, far smaller than that. The Saldanha was probably about 150 feet in length, just a little bit short of 150 feet. Still a substantial vessel with a crew of maybe 270, 275 sailors. So very, very busy location at the time. On a patrol at the start of December, the Saldanha and a smaller vessel, the Talbot, went north from Loch Swilly and encountered the start of a hurricane. And it was truly a horrendous storm. We've got lots of other reports of ships that foundered that night and of damage being done to buildings and roofs and chimneys. It was a fairly unique storm, what the sailors would have called a true hurricane. As the Saldanha would have attempted to get to shelter, she entered Loch Swilly, and we know some of the story as to what happened. Still some mystery there.
Yeah, so, and this would be, what do you do in the case of high winds or hurricane, right? The sails, massive. So you drop the sails or you drop some of the sails and you try and, you know, then, of course, the ability to steer the vessel is compromised. I mean, it's the worst case scenario to be in a boat like that, isn't it, with incredibly high winds and turbulent waters. It must have been horrific to be aboard.
Absolutely horrific. So every sailor has a few things they can do in these conditions. You can go to bare poles, take down the sails, scud on front of the wind. That means you're going as slowly as possible, more or less in the same direction as the wind. You can try and veer up into the wind and actually make way at an angle into the wind and try and keep your position that way. Very few other things you can do when you're in something like a hurricane in a square-rigged vessel. So We're pretty sure from reports of other vessels that they had to scud on front of the wind. There wasn't much else they could have done. We have the logs of the Talbot, and the Talbot ended up the following morning in the area of Clew Bay, that far south. And we've got some great reports from the Talbot with regard to the conditions. We're pretty sure the Saldanha, wherever she was, had to scud on front of the wind. We're also reasonably confident. Now, we've got to be like journalists here. You know, these days, you've got to check again. You've got to find the primary source for everything. And about half of what you hear is completely wrong. And we've got to take exactly the same approach. We've got to look for the veracity and we've got to find primary sources. We're fairly certain she entered the lock at around 10 o'clock on the night of the 4th, coming south at a rapid pace down the lock. We're confident that she hit at the Swilly Rocks. They're the rocks on the west side of the entrance to the lock. And we have some evidence of that. We have some reports of that. And again, the reports are from fairly credible sources. So that one is a confident of, but not certain of. And then we've got other debris that's been recovered over the years. Anchors that have been recovered from the area north of Dunree, between Dunree and the Swilly Rocks. The masts and sails of the Saldanha came in at Dunree the following morning. So what's a very likely thing to have happened is that when she clipped the Swilly Rocks, she lost her rudder, she lost her rudder chains, and she was demasted or partly demasted at that point. Now, that would be a normal thing to happen if a sailing vessel of that vintage had a collision. So fairly confident up to where she clipped the Swilly Rocks, but she didn't break in two at that point. One thing the English have very, very well is historical documentation and public service records. So we can pull the logs and records from Kew Gardens in London, and we know exactly what was in the hold of the Saldanha. She didn't break in two on the Swilly Rocks. There's a very characteristic signature of the point she broke into.
Now, in relation to what has been revealed with the movement of sands, it's clearly a structure of some description or other. It's too uniform. It does offer itself to be a vessel of some description or other, and then you think of what might it be or what could it be. That's not enough, of course, to confirm this is indeed the wreck of the Royal Navy frigate. But in terms of confidence, where are you at now at this point that this actually could be the final resting place of this boat, this ship?
So we approach this stage a little bit like a forensic investigator. What is telling you it's not the wreck? What is telling you it is the wreck? So the shape, as you say, that shape looks to the eye like it's the starboard bow. And there's almost 12 metres of debris of a structure. Now, that's about 40 feet. And the vessel itself was only 150 feet long. And we have all the original shear drawings. We have the equivalent of the build data for the Saldanha, so we know exactly how far back that section goes. So that's all quite consistent with it being part of the starboard bow. But there's other things then that are a little bit inconsistent. We, again, have got loads of records of the morning after the wreck. We know that the Saldanha was split two. She was in two separate parts with debris everywhere. The main reports we have are of the wreck being in the south of the lock. Sorry, the south of the bay. So quite far away from where this debris is shown. We don't have any records for half of the vessel ending up, or a third of the vessel ending up in the mid part of the
bay. But we don't know what may have happened underwater with currents either, though, at the same time as things were emptied out.
Once she sat and they began to empty her, It's unlikely something of that size moved. Now, right down at the level of the keel, there were huge heavy weights, big, big, big iron bars used for ballast and gravel used for ballast. So once she was broken to actually sat on the beach, she was actually going to sink in situ. She was going to sink in place.
So is this kind of like trying to prove a negative then? How would it find its way to where it's been discovered then, given everything you've just said?
Absolutely no issue with that. It is completely feasible and possible that it's there. I just don't have reports that say the following morning they actually saw it at that point.
Now, we've lots
of reports from the following morning.
We've seen we're just seeing sort of the ends of some of the structure. What's next? If you were to excavate down to expose everything that is actually lying there within the sand, I mean, what likely would we discover?
So it's the bow, and they kept the bow reasonably light. They put a lot of the ballast and a lot of the weight would have been amidships. It's 40 feet long, which means that we're into a part of the hold that would have had stuff in it. Mm. And we absolutely know what would be at the lowest levels. So let's assume it's still all intact, and let's assume that we've figured out what we're actually seeing. We can see joints on the bit that was exposed. Those joints are called scarfs. Now, I can go back then to the original designs of the vessels, and I can tell you at exactly the height they are above the keel. So either you're looking at something that's 8 foot above the keel or 12 foot above the keel. Apologies for using imperial measurements. Everything in the old records is imperial. We'll move away from
that. I'm not going to lie to you. It suits me.
So we know that if it's the lowest joints it can possibly be we're looking at, that there's potentially 8 feet or so from there to the keel. Above the keel, there's some very characteristic things. So that iron ballast isn't random lumps of iron. It's got a particular pattern. It's got a particular shape. It'll have Admiralty markings on it, and it will have holes in exactly the right places. So if it is excavated at some point in the future, we will be able to say definitively that's an Admiralty ship. And we also know definitively that no other vessel of that size would have broken up at that point.
We're interested in it because there's history here, there's a story here, and it's local, and the way it's been revealed is really interesting. How interested are the British in relation to this? Like, is this just another vessel that may have perished during that awful weather? Like, hundreds would have, I suppose, over centuries. Is there any particular interest in this from the British? Will they be watching on? Might they be interested in some sort of an excavation?
Oh, absolutely. So we can say without contention that we have a very mixed history, but we've got to appreciate that in the Napoleonic era, about 20% of those who fought with the English were Irish.
Mm-hmm.
England had a much smaller population at the time, and we were a great source of warm bodies for those folks. But separate from that, everybody's heard of the Duke of Wellington, the Pakenhams, Lord Longford. Captain Pakenham of the Saldanha was one of the Longfords he was Irish. We know, looking at the muster, we know the people who were aboard, and a lot of those people were Irish. Not just were they Irish, some of them will have volunteered for... You know, it was a very, very poor country, and it was one way out of poverty, although it was a horrendous existence, but people were also pressed or impressed. That means a bunch of sailors would go down to the local pub with cudgels, knock people over the head, drag them back to the boat legally, and they were impressed into the Navy. So a lot of those people weren't volunteers. Some of them were lifted out of fishing boats. One of these vessels could pull up alongside your fishing boat, lift you out of it, your family never saw you again. So there's a huge mixture of cultures here. The English are absolutely fascinated by their military history and have absolutely no doubt that we will see interest from the UK. If you want to see what the Saldanha looked like, there's a very well-restored vessel sitting in Hartlepool Harbour. So a quick flight into Newcastle, an hour's drive south, and there's a beautifully restored vessel called the Trincomalee sitting in Hartlepool. And honestly, unless you're an expert on the individual vessels, you wouldn't be able to distinguish between that and the Saldanha.
A caller says, I heard a story that some years ago when there was a particularly low tide, the rudder of the ship was found lodged in a rock at the mouth of Loch Swilly, probably still there. I'm not sure if there's... Have you heard that story before?
Oh, I've heard exactly that story, and that's consistent with everything else we know. Okay. So I have that from the 1970s in my... lists, but unfortunately it's anecdotal. I don't have the original.
I think this might be the anecdote we're leaning on here. Is this the same ship that a load of gold was supposed to be found on?
So, Greg, you have me on video.
Yes.
But the listeners won't have. Can you see my wedding ring?
I can, yes.
Can you?
Yes. No, I can't see your wedding ring. Of course
you can't.
No, yeah.
So that's the only way I can say with confidence that there's gold on the wreck of the Saldanha.
Okay.
During a long dive many, many years ago...
That's where you lost.
...with freezing cold hands, the ring came off. So a message to future archaeologists, if you find the ring, please return it. My wife would appreciate it.
And in terms of finding out more information, is sand too dense for any sort of ground-penetrating... technology? This would require an excavation, and what would be the next step in that regard?
So we're very, very careful to be non-invasive, and it's more than just idealism. As time goes by, technology improves, and something that will destroy an artefact today, we can do non-invasively in 20 years' time. So you'll find archaeologists being incredibly conservative. There are techniques we can use right now. So we know there's iron down there, and a magnetometer will let us see iron at that sort of depth and allow us to calculate depth and volume or mass of iron. There's ground-penetrating radar that we would use on land a lot. Now, I'm not confident that will work in that wet environment, and we know there's also a lot of iron material.
It's just the density of the sand as well, too, I'd imagine. It's complicated.
Density isn't so much. For ground-penetrating radar, I could take something that looks like a wheelbarrow outside your house and it could map all your pipes and the electricity feeds coming in. So density is not so much a problem. It's the wet environment that gives us some issues. There's another device called a sub-bottom profiler where we put low-frequency sound waves down through the actual surface of the sand, and that's absolutely magic. But again, we need a certain depth to use that. We need the depth of water. And that particular bay, when you've got a high tide, 4 metres of tide, you'll have rolling waves coming in there.
It's
a really challenging environment to work with. So there are a range of instruments we can use.
Okay.
We have to be non-invasive.
Yeah, but you've got patience. So in other words, I'm impatient. So like, I'm not going to get an answer anytime soon. You're just sitting there going, it could take 30 years. And I so much admire it, John. But for me, like, I was hoping, like, do we start tomorrow?
What I can tell you is that even the part of the wreck that was just still exposed is actually disintegrating.
Yeah.
So if we excavate, it's a one-go job.
Exactly.
We will destroy absolutely everything that's there, and that the opportunity to study it further in the future is gone.
Sure.
Now, the competent authority is the Monument Service, and they are going to come back down again in March, and they are the folks with resources and top-end skills that will allow them to investigate further without destroying the wreck. We can work locally with our own resources, privately, but honestly, we are constrained. Like thousands of other people in Donegal, I have defective blocks. And at my age, I'm facing either with things get sorted or I'm homeless, which is something that I never expected in my 60s. So unfortunately, putting large resources into this is beyond me at this stage.
Well, listen, I wish you the very best in navigating that process. It is not easy. Local archaeologist John O'Rourke, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Greg.